Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit in creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have the author of this book, Music, Porn, and Jesus. His name is Jerry Dale, and he has an amazing, amazing story. Jerry is the author of this book, Music, Porn, and Jesus. He's studying for his Master's of Divinity. He's a preacher and a teacher. And welcome, Jerry.
Hey, how you doing, Hillary?
Good. I think this might be the most interesting story I've ever had. So I just want to say, wow. Wow, wow, wow. Yeah. So, okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think where we can start is back in your childhood and how you were raised. I think it's so, you know, when you were saying you grew up in a safe, secure neighborhood environment where, you know, you never had to worry, right?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, my parents, you know, they're still together today. But I grew up, it's interesting because I actually grew up, I was the only African-American in my neighborhood, right? But I went to school over in the hood. So we used my grandma's address so that I could go to school over there in elementary, more so because I could catch the bus and then go to my grandma's because my parents both worked, right? And so I grew up both with both sides, right? I had, you know, this side over here where I was in the hood, the African-American hood or neighborhoods. But then at the end of the day, my mom would pick me up after work and then I would go to the other side of the tracks, so to speak, or literally on the other side of the tracks. And I would be in a neighborhood where nobody else looked like me, but those were all of my friends were over there as well. So yeah, I had a mixture of both. I had balance.
And what were your parents? I mean, I'm just curious. Like, what were they doing in that neighborhood instead of being over with your grandmother?
Say that again.
Like your grandmother was over in the hood.
Right.
How come your parents moved out? They were just doing better. They could.
Yeah, just doing better. Yeah. You know, ironically, most Black people, as they start to do better, they don't want to live, they want to be as safe as possible, right? They want to live places that are safe as possible, and it's just what it is, right? And so, you know, I wasn't even born in the African-American neighborhood, because when I was born, my parents had already moved out. So my dad worked for the city, and my mom was going to nursing school. And so then my dad ended up getting the job for the railroad. And so he started doing, you know, extremely better, especially, and this is the 70s, right? I was born in 71. And then my mom was still in nursing school. And then eventually she ended up being, she ended up teaching kids who were, they were challenged kids. I don't know back then they used different words for it, but you know, they were challenged kids. So she did that. And then
special ed type of thing.
Yeah, probably a little more than special ed.
Like in school or some other place?
Yeah, in school. Okay. Yeah, okay. In school. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so she worked there, and then she eventually had a child care center. And then she dealt with she did that for, I don't know, 40 years, something like that. They had moved, but you know, then even moving in that neighborhood, and I didn't know this until I was a little bit older, but there were petitions that were signed to keep us out of the neighborhood, right? And I didn't know until I was older that people, you know, they didn't want us living over there, because we were at that time the first African Americans to move into that neighborhood. It was a new and developing subdivision of the town.
So obviously the petition didn't work and you moved there, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Wow. Okay. So you kind of had both. You had the hood. You know, I never realized hood came from neighborhood.
Right.
I never went to do it together.
Most people don't.
Yeah. So anyway, so you had the hood and then you had your where you lived.
Right.
So you had really both.
I did. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the unique things I like to say. Most people live either or, right? And nowadays it's a little different, but we're talking in the 70s.
Yeah.
It wasn't the same, right? You either were on, you know, you either lived over there or you did, you know, it was like you were just in the hood. Like you didn't really just get out like that in the 70s. And there are other people who did, but for the most part, it was not that way.
Yeah. Right. Now, one of the things you talked about in the book is the hustles that your grandfather and your father always had side hustles.
They did.
That's kind of where you got your hustle from. Like, what does that actually mean? It's not necessarily illegal, right? It's just a way of making money.
Correct. Right. Yeah. So really back then they called it moonlighting. Right now it's called hustles or side hustles, right?
Oh, it's but just like a second way to make money.
Second way
it's
to make
not money. Your day job.
Okay. Right. It's not your day job. Right. So now, yeah, like I said, so my dad, he worked for the railroad, but he also owned a car lot. Right. And so during that night he worked on the railroad. By day he was selling cars. Well, even being in the car business, there's, you know, when you're there's always things or people who have different ways. And so my dad always had people coming to him. Like when I was 10, I had a go-kart, right? Somebody had a go-kart. They couldn't, with real gas, and they couldn't, you know, it was fiberglass. It was nice. They didn't want it. So he worked a deal and got the go-kart for me, right? You know what I'm saying? So he knew how to hustle from that aspect, but that was because he was in the car business too. You know, and my grandpa, he cut yards. He cut all the yards in the neighborhood. He worked for the oil company, Champlin Mansion. I don't know, it's Champlin Mansion. They had a mansion, but it's Champlin Oil Refinery. He worked at the barbecue place. I mean, you know what I'm saying? He worked multiple jobs. And so it was like a hustle. Like he was just always being able to make money and do things. And so as a kid growing up, I didn't call them hustles, obviously, because I didn't know that was a name that you could use for that.
Mm-hmm.
But I did understand how they moved to be able to make money in different areas. And it wasn't always one area. And then as I got older, it became a way, like when I had my first child, I think I was 21. I didn't ever want anybody telling me how or when I could buy her ice cream. Right. I wanted to be able to buy her ice cream cone when I wanted to. But if I only had one source of income, they kind of controlled when I could buy that ice cream. But if I had multiple sources of income coming in, then I could pick and choose on when I want to buy her some ice cream. And I had that mentality from a young age.
And that's because you got paid on a certain date? Is that like, why did they control it when you could buy her? I'm just trying to.
So if you only have, you get paid every 2 weeks, you only got one income. You know, but if you got five or three incomes coming in, then you can kind of you can just go do what you want to do. You got more income coming in, right? And if you lose one, then you can still go get it, right? You know, you can just kind of and it's more of a mentality than anything, right? It's yeah. Kind of just the way I moved.
What was your first one? What was your first one?
Well, when I was in middle school. In the eighth grade, I started, I had cousins that were in California that would come visit us every summer. And I talk about this a little bit in the book. Yeah. We would do it back then. We had cassette to cassette. And so I would record the music that they would bring from California. Cause in Oklahoma, we didn't get, we last to get the new music, you know, from the West Coast. I would record it and then I would turn around and sell it. So I was like making a little money doing that, and that's in middle school. Again, it's the mentality of just being able to like, oh, okay, well, let me make a little money. I can do this. Nobody else has this music. Let me do it. Yeah.
All right. What was next?
So after that, in high school, I started to try to sell drugs, and I don't even really know what that was, because it wasn't like I needed to, but I did. I never really asked my parents for like they didn't give me like an allowance or anything like that. But I ended up getting caught. So that was short lived. I got caught by my parents, by my mom, and I write about this in the book. And yeah. She told me, she's like, I'd rather see you dead than selling drugs. And so it was one of them things where, yeah, that was short lived.
You know, I just have to say, my son, when he was in middle school, he used to hang out at this skateboard park, and you know, someone, he knew that the guys there had pot.
Right.
And one of the kids in school said I don't know how it happened, but he said he wanted some, and he was like, oh yeah, I can get you some. Like, yeah. Someone wanted, you know what I mean? He wasn't really thinking, and we found out, and he was like really nervous. He was getting sick, even though he was just trying to help his friend. Right.
Right.
But then someone told him, you can't do that. Like, you know what I mean? He was just naive.
Right.
And that stopped. But it was the same thing. Like,
yeah,
just trying to help a friend. He didn't really get it. He wanted it. Middleman. Anyway, but he did stop.
And that's really where it stemmed from. It was really being the middleman. Because even in high school, I could grow a full beard and I was 17 years old. And I was a young one in my grade, and there were people, you know, in high school who wanted to drink, and they drank alcohol. I was never really a big drinker, but I had one of my friends in the hood. His grandpa, I think I've talked about this in the book, his grandpa was the bootleg, and he would let me, because he knew me, but he also knew my parents, and he knew I was on the other side of town, and it was just things that kind of could make it work. At least in my mind, I thought this was why. He would let me come, and I could buy Wild Irish Rose, Mad Dog 2020, Moonshine. He had Moonshine, and I could buy it from him, and then I could take it over to my white friends, and I could sell it to them, and they could have the alcohol, right? So I was kind of like the middleman. It was more, and I didn't like try to make a whole bunch of money off of them, but I could go get it for them and keep, yeah. You know, and again, I have balance. I could do both. Not everybody could go to the hood and get this and then come over here and do this. We don't have the friends to do this, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. Now, were you underage at that point?
Oh, yeah. I was 17.
Oh, my God. You were already 18.
Wow.
Yeah. I was in.
All right. Underage, yeah. But you didn't get caught doing that one.
No, I didn't get caught doing that.
Okay. So, yeah. So it was just making it.
I was the middleman. I was, they wanted. You know, I think it was just easier than them trying to go and get a fake ID and go to the liquor store and do all of that, right? So, it depends on perspective, right? Maybe I helped
them. Providing a service, yeah.
Yeah, provide a service. I helped them out. I helped them stay safe.
Wow, okay. So that's how it all began, right?
That is.
You were the middleman. I mean, that's really what you became.
I did. I became the middleman. Yeah, all throughout. That's what, wow. That's what it was. I went to college. I did 1 year of college in Weatherford, Oklahoma, right? At Southwestern Oklahoma State. And while I was there, I threw parties. I was a party promoter on the campus. I did all those things. But even with that, I had relationships. You know, the guy who owned the club, the bar that let me DJ in, he also owned the only steakhouse in the town, right? So I was able to, I could eat good, you know, and I could DJ, right? But he would only let me DJ hip hop music on Thursday nights if I stayed and DJ country music on Fridays and Saturdays. And so this is now we're talking like 91, 92, somewhere 89, 90. And so this was like Garth Brooks, Friends in Low Places was big. So this was that era of music. And so this is where I learned country music.
Oh.
And so, you know, I learned a little bit of country dance, two-step, just because I'm playing country music two nights in a row on the weekend. But that's the only way that we could play hip-hop on Thursdays. And so, essentially, I guess it's another one of them, I'm helping the other side, right? I'm helping my people, right? Where we can, y'all want to hear hip hop? Okay, I'm going to take the sacrifice, right? And sacrifice from the car today. And I'm going to go stay here and play country music on the weekends and not knowing I really don't like country music.
Wow. Yeah. So it seems like it was just natural for you.
It was. Yeah, music was natural. I mean, I was in sixth grade, fifth grade, my great aunt, she wanted me to pick up a music, an instrument. And so I played the saxophone. And so she gave me private lessons. So fifth grade, I was into music then. I was learning music then and playing it.
And you loved it?
I did.
Yeah. I did. Wow. You still play the sax?
No, I don't play, but I'm trying. I got a buddy who's a drummer. I'm trying to get him to find someone to teach me again, because I never really learned how to read music. I always played by ear. And so I can probably pick it up and play some stuff now, but I do want to get someone that can kind of help me just at least in the beginning, right? To get me started again until I can get going. And then once I get going, then I'll just continue doing it on my own.
Cool. Okay. All right. So after high school, you went to college, right?
I did. So I did only one year in Weatherford, Oklahoma. And then after that, my first wife got pregnant. And so I had a daughter, my oldest daughter. And then I ended up leaving. I saw a commercial on TV. It said, wanted to be in the music business. And it was a MTV commercial for the Art Institute of Dallas. And so I ended up moving to Dallas, and I went to school at the Art Institute and majored in music and video business. And it was a 2-year degree. It was an associate's degree, but I moved there and went to school there. And then I ended up getting into the music industry from being at that school.
Mm. Okay. And what was your first job out?
My actual first job was at MCA Records. That's not true. I had an internship. So two things. There was a Budweiser Superfest was a big like a country fest. They would put on shows, right? Concerts. So I essentially talked to one of my professors into allowing us to go and set up as a news crew. So I talked to Steve. I got my classmates. I talked to Steve. I got us backstage. We interviewed most of the artists that were performing, but I did one interview with Belle Biv DeVoe, right? And they, Michael Bivins, interviewed him, and I asked him a question about Boyz II Men suing him because he was the label and management, right? There was a local video show there, taped my interview, and then I didn't know they were taping it, right? And so the next weekend, The following weekend, Monday, when we came back to school, someone said they saw me on TV. And I was like, I don't know that, right? We talked about it. And then it was that interview that I did. So I'm asking my professor, hey, well, can I sue him? Yeah, I'm 19, 12. Well, no, Emily was born. So I was 21 at this time, 21. So I'm asking him, can I sue him? You know, I don't have no money, right? But I'm in school. So I got a green suit. I had a 78 Chevy Nova. I drive over to these people's office and I'm like, hey, I got my little briefcase. I'm going to sue you for airing me without my permission, right? The guy, he gave me $2,000 cash and gave me an internship to go collect videos from the record labels. And so as I was doing that, with them, I met a guy named Jeff Thomas, who was at MCA Records, and he asked me to bring him back some information on college radio. I got the information, brought it back, and then he started teaching me how to work records in the music industry, essentially under the table, because he wasn't paying me, but he was teaching me and showing me around, taking me all the people and doing all the things to show me how to do it. So, and from there, I picked up a gig with Luke Records, because now I kind of knew what to do. So I picked up a gig from Luke Records, and that was essentially my first job, paid job, was that with Luke Records. And so I started doing that with Luke.
All right. And that's when things started changing.
Yeah. Things started changing. Things started changing. I had that. I picked up, you know, once it's one of those things, like once you get one client, because I had my own company. Once you get one client, then you can pick up another, another, and another. And I ended up picking up Epic Records and Columbia Records. And so I picked up other record labels as well, Priority Records. And so I was what they call an independent record promoter. But I was doing more street promotion. So I was in the nightclubs. I was on doing mix show on the radios, and so I was doing the street level entry of music industry. I can remember times, and I was talking to one of my cousins recently. I can remember times when on Sundays after, you know, in the evening, everybody would go down to the park and play basketball or whatever. My mom, I'd be the only one. My mom would come pick me up 6 o'clock. We had to be at church at 6:30. Church started. They're picking me up. I'm leaving. I'm the only one leaving to go to church.
And was that okay with you?
I didn't have a choice. I was in middle school, high school. I didn't have no choice. I was still living at home. I had to go by their rules, house rules.
All right. So when did the so we covered music, the porn stuff. When did that all start?
When I was at Sony Music, so we were talking, now we're talking 2000.
This later
Yeah, this is later. This is
after Luke?
after Luke. Yeah, after Luke. So after Luke, I was.
But wasn't there bad stuff with Luke?
Oh,
That's
all
same
of
stuff, terrible stuff.
So yeah, so Luke. So with Luke, Luke was kind of like being in the adult industry and the music industry at the same time,
Okay.
because all of the Luke, like the girls that he would have that would be on stage, ironically, were locally here in Dallas. And so because I'm here in Dallas, I was kind of like their, I won't say handler, but I made sure they got to the show. I made sure they did all the things that they needed to do whenever he was performing within my market, right? Other than that, they would fly out and go wherever, whatever market they were going to.
So what were they actually, how did that relate to music, these girls?
Because they would have to, they would perform on stage.
Oh, these were live performances.
These were like dancers. That's what I'm saying. Luke's music was like adult entertainment and music at the same time. It was like being in both industries.
Oh, so I thought you were bringing like records around for
I
people to
was,
play,
I was, I
but
was.
you were also bringing live performers.
So I was bringing the records around for Luke, right?
Yeah.
But then whenever Luke would come and perform, right? Or whenever he had artists on his label that would come into town and perform, when they're performing on stage live, they need some extra entertainment.
Oh.
So I would bring the extra entertainment.
And was Luke a performer too?
He was. He did perform. Yeah.
Okay. I thought he was just the
Owned
boss.
it. Yeah, he owned it. He was a performer first. Yeah. And then he ended up owning it. Yeah, owning that label. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So you're hanging around with these
Yeah.
people.
Yeah.
And what was the stuff that you saw that started, you started thinking,
Oh, I mean, there's just so many things. I saw women do things with their genitals that you just, it's just questionable. You know, it was just questionable.
On a stage?
Oh yeah, on stage. On stage. Yeah, we would. There was times there was shows where we got shut down. I can remember one show in particular. We were in South Dallas at the Force Theater, and you know they were on stage doing their thing and doing sexual acts on stage. And this is 90s, right? This is mid 90s,
This is gentlemen.
mid 90s.
These are strip clubs, I'm assuming.
This was at a no. This was not a strip club. This was at a actual venue. That he was performing at, and the girls were on stage doing their thing. And this is what, and this is again, this is what it was. This is just what it was. And the police came in. They pepper sprayed everybody. And we had to run out the back door, run off stage. I had to grab the girls and grab the yeah. So I mean, yeah, I saw things like, and now I'm in my 20s, right? And at this point, I'm married too. You just, I just saw the way women would let men treat them. And then I saw the things that women would do on stage for money. And now that I'm older, I see that that was their environment. You know, they had broken home. I mean, they were just broken from when they were younger. Back then, I didn't understand all of that then. You know, it's just one of those things where it's like, oh, I'm just seeing these women. Like, I can't even believe this is happening. Because my mom wasn't like that. You know what I'm saying? I didn't come from a family like that. I had seen people be like that. And now I'm seeing this.
Okay. Now, so you had, with your first marriage, you had how many kids? Two?
Two kids.
And what happened to that marriage?
That marriage was, it was my fault. We got divorced. No excuses, but just kind of telling you what it is. Just me being in the music industry. When I went to Sony, you know, in the 90s, when I got hired on at Sony, I had to let my company go. And so I had called my cousin and asked him, like, look, I need you to come down here, start learning this, because we still wanted to get the checks. We didn't want to give this up to somebody else, right? So we needed to find a way. So you come down, you take over the company, you run the company, I'll go into Sony, right? So when I went into Sony, you know, we had like huge artists, Destiny's Child, Jagged Edge, Maxwell, Mariah Carey, Jennifer Lopez. We had huge artists at that time, and they were still developing artists, but the label, the company was putting a lot of money into them. And so you just get, I was 24, maybe 25, somewhere in there, early to mid 20s still. Just get caught up. You know, there's so many groupies that come around. There's so much, and you're in that environment, and you just, as a 20-year-old, I just got caught up in doing things and let me just say this. I had a conscience. I did. My wife never caught, I never got caught doing anything. You know, I'm sure she suspected things. You know, we talk about it now. She's like, yeah, when I look back, yeah, da 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 da, right? And so we decided to separate. And then that was like the demise of that marriage. Once I did that, because I started doing, I went to go do a, again, I'm hustling, that hustling mentality. I went and got a whole other apartment, and I started doing poker games. You know, and then from the poker games, you start having a lot of people coming in that, you know, some of them are high profile people. Now you got to provide extra entertainment, you know what I'm saying, for them, because poker games the last 2 or 3 days at a time. And so now I'm literally the middleman. And I think there's a chapter in there, chapter 5 or 6, called That Guy. That's really what that's about. That's what I was, that guy.
How did you make money doing those games?
Oh, the poker games, the house always gets a scrape off of every hand. So there's that. And then when you provide the services, you don't always make money at the moment, but you'll make money on the back end, because you'll do another deal with an individual that's there at that table. It's kind of like, you know, how people play golf and they always say, oh, you go on a golf course, you broker a deal, you can make a deal on the golf course with the guy. Kind of the same thing. We're okay. Sitting there, you know, saying, we're talking.
See what you can do.
Yeah, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, it's like, I got one guy who was a high level executive at a major company. Even to this day, I mean, they're just a large company, right? He had friends, college buddies, that was coming into town. They didn't all live in the same town. Right. So they wanted to get together and have a party. Well, you need somebody to provide entertainment.
But how did you make money? Let's say you get the girls. They got to get. So is there like a spread, like you pay the girls so much?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of things that were just done on favors, right, to start with, right? So it's just like, you know, I'm just in the middle offering the opportunity for the girls to be able to do something, right? And then I'm offering him the opportunity so we can work something out on the back end. We can always work something else out. 'Cause you know, with depending on the company, depending on what they're doing or what the guy's trying to do, you know, I could, I could use services. We could barter something. I mean, there's always other ways. So it's not always just about monetary. But it's the relationship of being able to make it happen, right? And then sometimes you do it because you know that it gives you the what's the word?
Power.
It does, right? And then but then when other people come to town, you get that phone call.
How did you make the money? Or you didn't care. You were just providing it and it worked out.
Yeah.
You're saying it just works.
And she just provided. Everything just works out. It comes out in the water.
You don't have to pay the girls something.
No.
They somehow ended up okay.
They do. They do.
All right. We don't have to get into the girls involved. I was just curious, like, how does that make money? Okay. All right.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. KIKORI.
Hey, it's Hillary from Getting Real with Hillary. I want to share something really powerful with you today. Jerry Dale was deep in the music industry, providing girls, drug, and gambling opportunities, all while justifying it as making a living for his family. He questioned his path, but then God turned his life completely around. Now Jerry's on a mission to redeem and help others find their way back from the dark side. Jerry's book, Music, Porn, and Jesus, A Journey to Redemption, is his raw, real-life memoir of how God rescued him from the music industry, the porn world, and his own rebellion. It's not just a story. It's a testimony of grace, hope, and freedom. Visit IamJerryDale.com to get your copy and join a movement of redemption. If God can do it for Jerry, he can do it for you too. Hey, it's Hillary from the Getting Real with Hillary show. Life can be messy, raw, and real. And sometimes we're afraid to feel vulnerable. We're afraid to be that real self. Well, that's exactly what the Getting Real with Hillary show and Getting Real movement is all about. Being our true selves. Every week, I bring you stories of transformation, authenticity, and hope. People getting real with their struggles, their faith, and their breakthroughs. So don't miss a thing. Subscribe to my weekly newsletter today. You'll get stories, links to everything new, and how to create a life you love every week directly to your inbox. You can also find my books on Amazon. My courageous and riveting memoir, The Second Piece of French Toast, In Case You Feel Stuck in Your Life and Want to Get Inspired. How I Came Out About My No Sex Life and My Marriage, and my second book, Real Talk. That one will get you speaking up in ways you've been too afraid to do so, and really creating amazing freedom. And my third book, How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun, the name is called Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. Find links to everything and subscribe to my YouTube channel, Getting Real with Hillary, and you'll find the links in the header. So visit, and you can also visit gettingrealwithhillary.com, because the real you is worth it and wants to come out. Well, thank you, as always, to our sponsor, Kikori. If you want to bring social-emotional learning to your schools, to your children, There's so many benefits, and it's really the wave of the future if we want to raise a generation of leaders, a generation of critical thinkers, kids who can not just survive, but thrive in this world. So check them out. Now we're going to bring back Jerry. Hello.
Hello.
All right. So I want people to get that you kept going kind of, and tell me if I'm saying it wrong, but down the dark side, you know, you ended up working with porn and all that, right? Stuff like that.
Yes.
Porn, you know, it was your work. You separated it. You justified it. All that stuff. What would you like to say about that so we can get to the new place where you were? But we got to take them down before we take them up. So great.
You know, it was, I'll say this. I didn't realize how dark of a place I was in. Because I could separate and, well, because I could compartmentalize things, it allowed me to justify it really easy. And because I was good at it, there were things that I didn't look at my skill set and say, oh, I could be doing, using my powers for good versus evil. Mm. I just kept moving along. And things, as I opened one door, the things just progressed. You know, it was a way of moving, right, that was instilled in, but I could have still done it differently. But it was just, I was in a music industry. I was in the music business, and that business was dark, right? But then I didn't realize it was dark because, you know, you're having fun. You're doing your thing. And then when it was the Luke, because Luke was, like I said, it was both. Like it was like being in porn and it was like being in the music together at the same time. And so it made the transition easy for me to go from the music to the porn, because I started doing, I left Sony and went to MCA Records. I was at MCA Records again, this time as an employee. I was only there for about a year. And they got bought by Geffen, and they let half of each staff go. So I was part of the staff that part of the half that got let go. And I had a friend who he was already doing some shows, and I had done shows before, produced some shows. So we started doing some Betsy Johnson fashion shows and doing a couple things together. And then he had an idea to do the Adult Entertainment Awards. And we did those. We put those awards together. He found somebody who wanted to actually buy the awards, but I didn't want to sell because I didn't have anything else going on. So I bought his half out, and then I produced the awards in 03 and 04. And again, this becomes the natural progression, right? So now I'm chasing the money, doing the awards. I do the awards. They come off great. First year I did them at a nightclub. Made money, did them on a Tuesday night. The club made money. I made money. Everybody made some money. I turned around, did them the following year at the Dallas Convention Center. Caught a lot of flack. I had protesters out there, and we in the Bible Belt. The thing is social media wasn't as prominent then as it is now. So I didn't have all that much. I didn't have that. But, you know, the mayor was Laura Miller at the time, and she was like, you know, they were on TV saying, oh, we're going to shut it. We're going to have fights there. We're going to do this, da, 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 da. Once I did those awards, then the strip clubs came at me, and I was able to go in and be the marketing director for, and Dallas has three of the largest strip clubs in the state. And I would say outside of Vegas, Dallas at that time had the best strip clubs other than Vegas, right? So I was the marketing director for two of the largest clubs in the city. And it was an easy progression because I already understood. I had been with Luke. So I had seen girls do. So it was when I came to these strip clubs, it was like clinical, right? Now I'm in my second marriage. But the thing was ironic is I didn't cheat or anything. Just keep it real. I didn't cheat in my second marriage. Everything was clinical. Like there was nothing new. Like these girls were tame compared to the girls I had saw at Luke. You know what I'm saying? It was like, oh yeah, this is easy peasy. So I was really able to compartmentalize even more. And just really kind of go in and do my job. You know, the offices we had were upstairs. So I didn't really have to mingle or co-mingle with the talent as much as you would think, right? Because I wasn't in there. I'd go down there to eat, or sometimes I even have my lunch brought upstairs. So, you know, so it's just a progression. But I think ultimately, I want people to understand this. Sometimes you can't see what you're in, and it takes you hitting a certain level or a certain bottom level or whatever before you can see it and see how bad it is. You just don't understand it. But no matter where you're at, you can get out. You can get out, and you can be saved, and you can do get away from that industry. It does take work, and it does take time, and you do have to close some doors. Some doors will have to be closed.
It sounds like it was just insidious, like just little by little by little, right? Mm-hmm. Like, hey, it was your job. Mm-hmm. What was the final straw that had you say, I got to get out of this?
Man, there was so many things. Well,
the health scares?
Health was huge. You know, I would like to say when I had a tumor on my pancreas, and the doctor told me it was from, you know, drinking and smoking. I didn't smoke cigarettes, but I puffed cigars and I smoked marijuana, right? Mm-hmm. He said that's where the tumor came from. I would like to say at that point, I can remember coming out of surgery and being like, oh, okay, Jesus, take the wheel. Like, I'm good. But I would tell you that wasn't the last time. Like, I lasted for a minute on the straight and narrow, but I got right back on the broad road right after that again, because I knew what I was good at, and it was a way of me being able to go make money at it, right? I could go make the money. So I would get back on that road. You know, I don't know if I could pinpoint any one thing. I think it was just really over time that it was almost like as I'm going down in this, God always had a hand on me and would convict me at certain levels. I mean, when I was at the Oklahoma City bombing, and I was in downtown Oklahoma City, that was a time when that happened. I came back like, oh, I'm quitting. I'm gonna quit working for Luke. You know, saying like, I'm done with this. I'm not gonna do this anymore. I was just coming off the road for working for him, and then it worked out where he fired me, right? Mm-hmm. He fell over the fax machine. It was funny, but anyway. So I think there was things as I was going down this way, God was kind of bringing me up this way. I couldn't see it back then, but there were just things, just little things that just kept coming. And I ended up just getting out of the business. And that was over time. I had to change my phone number because you're getting calls. Like, when people would come to town, because I was that guy, they would call like, hey, I need this, or can you do this? Or, you know, so if you don't close doors, change numbers and do those things, then it's harder to get out. I got out and I started doing like just consultant work. So I did that in my 40s. So this was like my 20s and my 30s was the music and the adult entertainment stuff. And then in my 40s, I started doing some consultant work. I had friends. I had good soft skills. So I was good at helping some business. I had buddies who needed some operations done, needed some sales management done, and different things like that. So I did that for a while. And then I started doing kitchen and bath remodels because I had an advertising business. So I always had an advertising company on the side. It was kind of like just my thing. I was good with that. And so I ended up doing kitchen and bath remodels for about 6 or 7 years. Did that. And then that's when I would say everything changed. In 2020, I had a quadruple bypass. And this was when I was doing the kitchen and bath remodels. 2020 was a really good year for me. And then, so in 2021, I ended up going into the hospital. I had a friend of mine, God used to save my life, because I was hard headed. I thought it was just another thing that I was going through, because I had been sick and been in the hospital before from dehydration. So I just thought that was kind of the same thing. Mm-hmm. But he took me to the hospital, got me in, and they told me I had three clogged arteries and at like 80%. So I never left the hospital once I got there. And then I had the surgery and I actually had four. And then from there, when I went in to surgery, I was like, if this is it, God, then this is it. I felt like I had from a worldly perspective, a secular world perspective, I had a good life. I mean, music business, I was 50 at the time. And I didn't want to die, but it was what it was going to be, right? Because it's surgery. I don't know. I never had heart surgery. As a matter of fact, I don't even know anybody in my family that's had heart surgery.
Wow.
So I go in, but when I came out of surgery, I still had the trach in, and I kept hearing that song from Frank Sinatra, "I Did It My Way." Right? Yeah, I'm telling you, I kept hearing that song, And so for me, it was literally, I said, "I did it. God, you let me do it my way for 50 years. Whatever time you give me left, I'll do it your way."
Wow.
Where I'm at now. Yeah, I ended up, my buddy who God used to take me to the hospital and save my life, I believe, I started going to church with him. He connected me in. Because of my background in marketing and music, he connected me with the worship director who was over there, large church. He connected me with the worship director. So I started helping them. They let me in some meetings, and he just kind of connected me. And this was all, to me, it was all God just moving. Mm. And I was able to start going to school, go to seminary. I got into seminary. And so now, yeah, this is the journey. And so I felt like there were things that I would start to forget with friends of mine who would call me and say, "Oh, you remember we went to this show, or you remember you took me here or there." And sometimes I would kind of say, yeah, because it was vague, but I couldn't remember details to it. And they would have to show me pictures. And so that's kind of what prompted me also to write the book, because I didn't want to forget things that I did know. Like, I didn't want to start forgetting everything because I've been to so many shows and done so many things that there was some I couldn't remember all of them. And so people would show me pictures. And there was one time that I was shown a picture and I still didn't remember being there. Wow. And it's like, I'm in the picture. And, you know, and back then it was like a hard picture, you know, because you had to go get them developed then. It wasn't a digital. So it's like, what's the word? They put me in the picture.
Oh, like, right.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It was like, it was an actual picture. And I didn't remember. I still didn't remember the event. And so, I need to do this. And most people, I would say, either do one or the other in terms of the industry. Most people will be in the music industry and then they find God, or most people will be in the adult entertainment industry and then they find God. Very few people that I know of have actually done both and then they find God.
You're an all around kind of guy.
I guess.
Wow. All right. So you talked about in the book, peace, two things, peace. And it keeps going in and out of my head about how God never gave up on you, that God, not just you, but all of us, that God loves us. It's an unconditional love. You know, I know a lot of times you think, well, I'm bad. I'm just bad. Right. People think that of themselves. Right. It's kind of nature. But that God loves us.
Yes.
So, you know, like I think, well, that's nice. How do I know that's true? You know, how do you know that's true? How do we know that? How do we know that God's really like that? And I know we don't know, but it's kind of like, if that was really true, and I know for you it is, I'm not saying it's not, but the part of my brain that doubts it, like, how could God love this when I get this way? And, you know, when my worst stuff is moody, or I'm in a bad mood, how could God love that? You know, but I know what you say is God does. So what would you like to say about either of those, the peace or the God loving us?
So I'll start with the peace and say that it took me a while to understand what peace really is. And so for so long as I had kids, I would always want peace. I'd be like, I just need y'all to sit down and be quiet sometimes, right? Or I would express things in a way that was not, in my mind, it was loving, but it didn't come across as loving. But I was the guy who I would express it very, very hard because I don't want to have to say it again. So let me give you all the energy now because I don't want to talk about this no more.
Right.
And so when it comes to peace, and that was my way of trying to get peace. I mean, I sat my kids down and said, "Oh, listen, I just want peace." Right. And they don't know what I was talking about. But I'll tell you this, really, for peace was this, to be able to have the unconditional love was kind of the peace and the love are kind of the same. They come together, right? And complement each other. To see my mom, she was one of those ones that just never worried about anything. She always, I always felt like she had peace. I've told the story, I think I mentioned it in the book, where, you know, I was at the hospital and I had a friend and she called, I called my mom until I was in the hospital. I said, "Hey, call my mom, let her know I'm in the hospital." My mom's talking to her on the phone. And I know what my mom's saying, but she's talking to her on the phone and she's like, "Okay, I'll talk to y'all tomorrow." And this was like 8:30, something like that, right? I mean, in the evening. And she got the phone and she's like, "Your mom said she'll talk to us tomorrow? Like, she's not worried about..." I said, "That's just my mom. She cuts her phone off at 9 o'clock p.m. And she said, if Jesus take you, ain't nothing she can do. And if he don't take you, she'll talk to you tomorrow." It will... That, but that sense of who she is allowed me to see peace in her. But also, she was also the one person that I felt always gave me unconditional love. And I know that's not the same for everybody. I know people, some people have issues with their parents or whatever. And I had an issue with my dad, right? And it's in the book. I talk about how he told me he wished he never had me. And so,
when was that? At what?
It happened three times throughout my life. Once when I was in my 20s. And in my 20s, I get it. Well, in my 20s, he wrote it. So that was probably the hardest. I didn't really understand why then. But in my 30s, it was more so because of the way I was treating my first wife and kids, right? He didn't want me to get a divorce. He didn't want me all the things I was doing. And so it was just one of those things where he just kind of said it. And then in my 40s, you know, I don't really recall the reason why he said it, but he said it again. So he said it three times in my life. But my mom was always, even when I was doing wrong, she would let me know I was doing wrong, but she still loved me. I knew that. And she wasn't a person. And the thing is, she didn't tell me she loved me a lot. It was more so just she showed it. And so to me, that was to see her be at peace, but to see how much she loved God and to see how much she loved me unconditionally. And so those two things, they kind of went together. So my peace started to come when I started to really not worry about things anymore. And really when I started to understand the sovereignty of God, my peace started to come, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of understanding that God loves me, for me, it really comes when I look back at my life and I see his hand in it. And so I think if people will look back at what you've been through and see that it could have been worse, you can see that God still loves you because he still gives you breath, right? So that you can have an opportunity to have a relationship with him. Because you have known someone, or you've heard of someone, or you've even seen on TV, some people's lives get cut short, right? And so the fact that you're still here, there is some love for you and opportunity for you to be able to change your life and have a relationship with him.
Wow. All right. We are on our last minute, believe it or not. What would you like to leave the audience with? What's your message? In a minute or less.
I would say that first and foremost, repent from your ways and have a relationship with God. Understand that God is sovereign. Even though we don't understand how he works and the way that he works, we understand that he does what he pleases. His will will always prevail over our will. And if you can understand that, if you can grasp that, and if you can seek that, then you will have, your life will change, and I don't mean change like you'll be holier than now, I mean, your life will change as to how you move and how you see things, and you will be able to have peace when you know that God is on your side and God loves you. Because we, even though we say that, having a belief, head knowledge, is not the same as having that belief in your heart. And we want to have that belief in our heart and not just in head knowledge. Because that doesn't get us through.
Wow.
And at the end of the day, I walk this journey with you. Y'all can go to IamJerryDale.com. You right? You can reach out. There's a way you can book me, but you can also just reach out through there if you need to. And I'm definitely open to walking the journey with anyone who's trying to get out of any dark places that you want to get out of. You know, I can give you the wisdom that I have, and we can just kind of go from there. But I am here for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jerry. Thank you for your authenticity, for your book, for sharing, for your courage, and for helping others. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me today.
You're welcome.
Good conversation.
Yeah, it was great. All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.